Disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome to AmCast. I'm Zach Burchy. Joining me this week, Justin, how's it going?
Yay.
Here to shoot the shit with us is Tim Mon from TimMonBooks.com, returning champion. Hey, Tim.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Pretty good, pretty good. How are you doing? I'm assuming that you're mostly preparing for the royal wedding, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm making bunting at the moment. do Americans know what bunting is?
We might have to look it up.
It's like okay. Those ruffles that go on windows, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like, well, over here, bunting is... I'm not really making bunting.
Okay, let's establish that.
Bunting is like bits of string you hang up that has little triangles of material underneath it.
Yeah, yeah. Colors.
Yeah, and you hang it up in the street and stuff. And when they used to care about things like that, like Royal Weddings over here, everyone would have a street party and you'd hang up bunting. That was before I was born. No one cares about it now. Do you know what I mean? It's like the media cares about it and the BBC's very excited. But someone did a survey a couple of weeks ago and it was like 78% of the population. I don't care. I'm getting a day off. Excellent. That's about it.
Really? You get a day off for that?
Yeah, we get a day off. Yeah, which is good. Which is a good thing.
I would assume that like the tabloid stopped caring so much because, you know, he stopped being attractive.
Well, that's your opinion, Justin. I wouldn't want to comment on that.
The girl he's marrying is very cute, but...
She's very cute, yeah. No, that's basically been the whole point of the media coverage is how cute she is. Because she is hot. There's no getting away from it. And it's not just the tabloids over here. It's certain of the broadsheets, the large papers, that are more right-wing, more conservative papers like The Telegraph, they've got it on the front page every day. I mean, I have a picture of, you know, Fukushima, and down the bottom they've got a picture of look what Kate's doing today. She's meeting some poor people and patronizing them or something, you know.
Well, the whole irony is that Americans are far more obsessed with your monarchy than you are. Right.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's why we still have them. Yeah. Basically, it's the only reason we still have them is so you guys come over and in plaid shirts and take photos of them and stuff. You know.
We ruin everything
and make Oscar award-winning movies based on them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, precisely. It's you know, so we can get a trickle of tourist money and a trickle of Oscars. That's it. That's the only reason we've got them.
So this is supposed to be about anime.
Yeah.
Justin, you been watching anything lately?
No, I haven't. I haven't really. Not anime. I've been watching some documentaries on Netflix. Most of them terrible.
Anything stand out?
Well, do you remember? This was like in film school. This was a big big hit at Sundance. Sex, the Annabelle Chong story.
Oh yeah, no, I saw that.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah, see, it seems like everyone's seen this, and I re-rented it because, you know, it was so long ago. I mean, 10 years is forever in internet and forever in porn years, and I was really curious to see if it stood the test of time, and it was one of those, like, back when DV camcorders were first starting to get respect as a legitimate medium, and it was just one of those really early DV documentaries. And it looks okay. It's one of those, and the porn parts are not shocking at all anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the filmmaker actually came to my film school and showed it, and like half the women left the room.
Well, that was 10 years ago.
They were just incensed that they were exposed to something like that. And all the guys were like, we get to watch porn in class.
Yeah. It's a pretty disturbing film, though, isn't it, from what I remember?
Oh, it's so not happy. But then again, what are you expecting of a porn star's life?
I think it put me off porn for, like, you know, a good like, weekend.
A good 20 minutes, yeah.
A good 20 minutes.
Tim, you been watching anything?
The sort of last few months, I haven't really watched much anime at all. People have probably noticed I don't talk about it that much.
No.
I've not been writing about it. Because I've had all sorts of weird real life shit going on, some of it good and some of it bad. I don't want to get into all that. too much detail, but yeah, last year was a bit of a crapper. This year is looking really positive, though, for a couple of reasons. But so I basically sat down, because when you asked me to come on, I'm like, shit, I better watch some anime, do you know what I mean? So I sat down today and I watched a few things that I'd been meaning to catch up on.
Oh, cool.
I watched, here I go with pronunciation time, Pula Maga Madoka Magica.
Madoka Magica, yeah.
Yeah, that thing, that's, like, got some beautiful animation in it. I've only watched the first one, and it's got some amazing, like, sort of trippy sequences in it, and sort of this post-apocalyptic stuff, and really kind of, like, almost experimental techniques in it. And then the rest of it's shit. I just thought the rest of it was terrible. I just didn't care about it. It was just girls doing really horribly stereotypical girl stuff and talking about boys and stuff. And it just bored the hell out of me. And I watched the first two of Wolverine and the first of Iron Man, which, because I've been meaning to catch up on those. I, you know, was never a massive like Marvel and DC fan as a kid, because I used to read a lot of British comics. But if I did read any, it was always coincidentally Iron Man and X-Men. So I was really interested to see what they'd done, and I quite like it. I like the Wolverine one because there's loads of violence. It's really nice. I mean, they're doing the sort of the bloodshed stuff that they can't get away with in the movies, so that's kind of good. And it's kind of got sort of like this sort of scrappy, dark feel to it, which reminds me of old anime. It was quite nice. The Iron Man one, I was kind of stoked for because it was Takashi Kogi directed the pilot, right, who's the red line guy. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a little flat, to be honest. It took a little while to build, but I'll watch the rest of it and see where it goes. I say I'll watch the rest of everything, and then I usually peter out after about six episodes of stuff.
Yeah, funny how that happens.
Yeah, I think it's me as much as it's the shows, though, to be fair.
It's when something is just not grabbing you all that hard, when you're leading a busy life, it's really hard to just stay with it. I mean, it's a commitment.
Well, exactly. I mean, I've been talking to like Zach about this a few weeks ago online. Me and my girlfriend just got into Mad Men, right? Like, because we didn't watch it when it was first on. And
life ends for about a week.
We watched, you know, like the first three seasons in about 10 days, I think. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It was just literally get home from work, have dinner, sit down, what should we do? I should put Mad Men on. Should I put another one on? Should I put another one on? Let's put another one on, you know. And you've watched like five in an evening. And I've got to go to bed. I mean, that's fantastic. And it's been a while. I'm trying to think the last anime show that really grasped me like that. There have been some. I think, ironically, the last thing that I watched that really grasped me like that was Tokyo Magnitude 8, which is now something I don't know if I'd be able to watch. Do you know what I mean?
But, yeah, you know, that was one that's been on my pile for years, and now I'm just like, no, not now.
Yeah, too soon.
Exactly. And if I had any criticism when it first was out, was that it was over-sentimental, and now I don't think I'd be able to watch it because of the sentimentality, and I think it would destroy me. Do you know what I mean? So, Yeah. So that's been about it for anime stuff and Mad Men. Anime and Mad Men.
Mad Men. It's pretty much my life too. Going back to Magica Madoka or Madoka Magic, whatever the hell it is. That's like kind of it's a phenomenon right now. It is the most popular show among the hardcore fans. It's a new Nanoha type of thing, where people are really super into it. At least that's what I've noticed. And they're saying, like, it's really dark and screwed up, and, oh, they're totally twisting the genre. And every time I hear that and I watch the show, it's never true for me. I never get grabbed by it. But everyone's saying it's, like, really great. So, I don't know. Have you even tried that one, Justin?
No. I looked at the key art, and I knew enough that it was not my thing.
It's worth watching. I mean, I'd recommend the first episode just for... I don't know if these carry on in the other episodes, but there's one sequence in it, which is beautifully done. It's really, really nice. And it's got, like, scanned textures and things like that in as part of the artwork and stuff. So it looks quite interesting, and it's very trippy. But the rest of it was, you know, like this sort of overtly moe kind of magical girl thing that, I don't know, it's just, I can't watch that stuff, man. I can't do it. I can't sit down and watch it. And maybe because I'm old and old-fashioned and, it's just, you know, watching, like, little girls doesn't, I don't feel right doing it. It just feels, not in a sexual way, it just feels like, well, I'm not interested in what little girls are doing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I'm a 37-year-old man.
Yeah,
it's just, robots. You know,
years after, I think as Central Park Media was winding down, I had a nice little talk with my old boss, John O'Donnell, and he was telling me, he just said something I'll never forget. He was like, you know, at some point I just realized, why, at a man of my age, why do I care what 14-year-old girls find hot?
Yeah, exactly. That's it on the nail, really. It's like, why am I interested in, you know, which boys are going to confess to them or whether they're going to confess to these boys and all this stuff? That, if it was live action, I wouldn't give a shit about it. You know what I mean? You know, if it was a UK show about these subjects, and there are UK shows like that, you know, like, you know, teenage soap operas and stuff. I don't watch that stuff. If it's American, I couldn't. I've got this real, you know, like almost phobia of like high school American drama stuff and cheerleaders and stuff. It drives me crazy.
So you haven't watched the MTV reboot of Skins?
No, man, don't start me on that. No, I haven't. I haven't watched Skins for a couple of seasons. I watched the first two seasons of Skins, and I quite enjoyed them because they're set in Bristol, which is where I live. So, and I know kids that are like that, and it really worked. It was a really local thing. And then it got a bit out of hand. They changed the cast and stuff, and I stopped watching it. I heard about this. Has that actually started then? Is that showing now?
They're through the first season, yeah.
Oh, really? I knew it was coming. I didn't realize they were that sort of, it was that imminent, or that it had started.
There was a brief moral panic.
Really? Was there?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, see, now we don't have that. We do have moral panics over here, but not about that stuff anymore. We've kind of,
well,
yeah.
I need to clarify about Madoka Magica, because we're going to get a ton of people in the forums telling us how stupid we are because we don't understand it, yada, yada, yada. That show is not, from what I understand, everything I've read about it, it's not for little kids, it's not for little girls, it's for otaku, it's all edgy and dark, and the characters die, and there's all this personal sacrifice and shit, and it's really trying to screw with all of those tropes. It's very dark. I get what you're saying, because I saw the first episode, I watched it for the preview guide, and my response was exactly the same as yours, is, wow, I'm really intrigued by this art style, I could not give a shit less about this story. But right. I just wanted to clarify, we understand it's not a show for little girls or even really about that kind of a thing. Like, it's more of a dark, edgy, fairy tale thingy. And that's what everyone's saying about it. So to head off,
I mean,
at the pass.
True,
yeah.
And they are twisting the tropes in it, then I'll stick with it and I'll give it a go. I'll give it a bit of a go, because that sort of thing I do find interesting. I mean, I've got a reputation for being the guy that likes Gunslinger Girl for that reason, you know. And the shit I get from that, from people that usually agree with me about stuff, is incredible. But, you know, that sort of thing appeals to me. Anything that takes a genre or a trope and subverts it, yeah, instantly I'm there in a snap. That's the sort of thing I want to be seeing. So if people are saying that's what it does, then I'll give it a go.
That's what everyone's saying. I just wanted to clarify, because, again, it's a super hardcore favorite of fans, and we will be called out and dragged across the calls if we don't get it right. So just to prevent that from happening. But we actually don't have – back to the Marvel stuff. We haven't gotten it here officially yet. It was all licensed by G4 TV. Which is a deep cable channel here, and I still haven't seen any of it, but that's interesting to hear about Wolverine, because I've heard nothing but negative things about all of it.
Really?
Yeah. Fans here who are pirating it, I guess, don't like it. They're complaining that it's not good enough, or it's not accurate enough, or it's mediocre, or whatever. I know Daryl Surratt has problems with the Iron Man anime and shit like that, so yeah, they're not being well-received.
I mean, Daryl's much more hardcore superheroes than I am. If you're a Marvel and DC fan, I guess I hear good things about the American-produced animation for those franchises. I've not watched any of it. I hear good stuff about the Avengers stuff or whatever it is, and I hear good stuff about all the Batman stuff. People seem to love that. And I have to admit, not being a massive fan, I've not watched any of that. So maybe in comparison to that, it's just not working. I just liked it because I sat down after watching that magical girl thing, and like Wolverine cut a load of people up. And it was like, you know, and he had a samurai fight with a guy who like was, you know, like cutting holes in him, and they were rehealing, and there was blood everywhere. And I was like, yeah, anime. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that again.
It's more your speed. All right. So last night, after not having seen it for, it's been about 6 or 7 months, I watched the Funimation Blu-ray of Evangelion 2.22.
Ooh, how'd that turn out?
It looks great. The Blu-ray looks fantastic. I have the Hong Kong Blu-ray, and I can't really tell a perceptible difference between the two, but the Funimation one looks gorgeous, just as gorgeous as the other one did. There's a bunch of extras on it. The packaging's really nice. They do a really nice job with these Evangelion movies at Funimation. They really put a lot of effort behind them.
Whenever the third one comes.
Yeah, who knows when that's going to happen. But I hadn't really revisited the movie. The first time I saw it, it was after midnight, and all I was just taken by how exciting it was and how great the action scenes were and how intriguing all the new story twists and turns were. And this time I had a little bit more of an analytical eye on it. Not to mention I watched a bit of the dub. I don't know why I did, because I don't like to watch Evangelion dubbed.
Well, it's better than the old dub still, right?
It is.
Is Tiffany Grant...
Tiffany Grant is Tiffany Grant. I will say this. I've been a critical of her performance in that role. And in this particular version of the character, I still don't like her line readings. I still think she saps a lot of the subtlety out of it. But her voice is still very unique. Because, to be perfectly honest, and this is not intended as an insult or anything like that, I have a hard time telling most female American voice actresses apart. They kind of all sound like they're doing the same voice for every character. Through no fault of their own, those characters all have similar voices. But they kind of all sound like the same person. But Tiffany Grant has a scratchiness, a deepness to her voice, a raspiness that's not very common. And while I don't like her performance per se, the line readings are off. I understand why people like that voice. But the rest of the dub is whatever. It's Spike Spencer trying to sound like a little kid. It's not. It's just not my bag. I don't like it. The Japanese version is way better. But the film itself, it's originally, like, I was much more gung-ho about how accessible it is. But on second viewing, it's not that accessible. You still will get a lot more out of it if you've seen the original TV series. I'm not sure you'd grasp the significance of certain events if you haven't seen the TV show. And it does feel... I think it would be confusing if you hadn't... Especially if you hadn't seen the first movie. But more so, again, if you haven't seen the show, it could be confusing. But one thing that really struck out to me, and I can't believe I never picked up on this before, and just maybe you can fill me in on this, because it's been a while since I've seen the TV show. In the original TV show was Evo 03 was the one that Toji piloted, right?
Right.
Was that an American? Was Evo 03 built by the Americans in the TV show?
Maybe. Yeah.
I don't remember.
I should have looked this up. But in the movie, this was a really bold commentary, and I'll preface it with this: Misato has a line when Shinji and Asuka move into her apartment, where Asuka's sort of responding brashly to Shinji, and she says, like, well, you don't understand the Japanese temperament, which is to be observant and compassionate or observant and considerate. Observant and considerate, which sort of suggests passiveness.
Right.
And this Eva 03 storyline, two of the Evangelion units are destroyed on site. And so the Americans basically say, we'll give you ours. We insist that you take our unit. And so they ship it overseas, and the caveat is that they have to put O2 on ice for... I can't remember the reason, but that was their agreement, was that they were going to put O2 on ice and use O3 instead. And then there's a short bit between Fuyutsuki and Gendo, where Fuyutsuki tells Gendo that the O3 is extremely powerful, is much more up-to-date, is much more high-tech, and could easily replace the other units as their main firepower. So the suggestion that this is this big, strong mech coming from America, superior to Japanese technology. Then they decide that Asuka is going to pilot it. A European is going to pilot this mech.
She's German, right?
Yeah, she's German. So it goes berserk, right? It rejects Asuka as a pilot, basically. And she starts having all these mental breakdowns, and the thing goes nuts.
Right.
So at this point, and as this is getting a little complicated, but you'll see where I'm headed with this. At this point, Shinji goes after it in Eva 01. And this is when they have the dummy plug backup system inserted into the back of Eva 01. And Shinji refuses to beat the shit out of Eva 03 because he doesn't want to hurt his friend. He's timid. He can't do it. He can't bring himself to do it. He can't bring himself to take the controls. So his dad flips off his switch and turns on the dummy plug, effectively rendering his Japanese timidness obsolete. And then it starts beating the shit out and ripping apart Eva 03. You see where I'm going with this?
Holy shit.
Is that, like, massively different from the series?
I can't remember.
I watched the series, like, maybe 2 years ago. That was the last time I watched.
I think it's been about 2 or 3 years for me, too. But I think I didn't quite pick up on it in the TV series because it wasn't quite so truncated, and I don't remember it being quite that direct.
Right.
Where it was, we're shutting off your Japanese-ness, and now you can destroy this foreign invader. Which just it was so stark to me. It was like, wow, is that really what they're saying with this?
But it sounds like the sort of thing he'd say.
Yeah, it doesn't really, it's not shocking, I guess, but no. It was just struck me as like, wow, like that's so direct. Like it's such a direct thing to say. Like no subtlety whatsoever. But I mean, the movie's got fantastic action sequence. I really like where they're going with it. And one thing I did want to say, and Justin, maybe you picked up on this too. It's been a while since you've seen the movie, I know.
Over a year.
But it seems to me like what they're doing with the storyline is, and I kind of hope they go this way, but I maybe they're not going to, but it feels like maybe they're making a little bit more of a direct line this way. I think they might be doing kind of a Golden Compass thing, where the villain is God, and what we're basically doing is breaking through his defenses. Go ahead.
Wow. Okay. No, because that's when I remember watching Eva for the first time and actually thinking that's what it was about for probably the first, like, good third of the series. And being really excited, thinking that's an amazing idea. What an amazing idea for a show. This is like our final showdown with God. And,
right.
And we've built giant mechs to do it. That's so twisted and amazingly interesting, but you think that's what they're actually doing now?
I kind of hope so. It could easily go there because there's all these references to when Shinji activates beast mode in the 01 at the end of this movie. They keep talking about how like he's extended beyond what humanity is capable of, and now he's more a deity than a man inside the Evangelion unit. So the idea that we're attempting to replace God and God is trying to stop us from replacing him is really cool. Yeah. And I kind of hope they're going to more directly go down that road in the third movie. I don't know if they will. I don't know if it's going to turn into a bunch of apocalypse gobbledygook like the original does. And I liked that, too. I thought that was great. But
yeah.
I really kind of hope that's the direction that they're going because this is really awesome.
that is awesome because literally, I remember thinking that. I love Eva, and I enjoy the ending and everything eventually. But, you know, I kind of was slightly disappointed when it turned out not to be about that. I remember going to a friend. This was, you know, it was shown on TV over here. It was shown on cable, like, God knows when, 10 years ago plus. I go, hey, you got to see the show. It's about these guys, and they're fighting God in giant mechs. And he went, that sounds really cool. Because it is really cool, you know. But that'd be interesting if they do actually do that.
If they go all the way, yeah, that would be that would be really, really cool. But who knows? I know that. I think it might be a result of the story just being so truncated and shrunk down narratively, so that this stuff isn't spread out over 15 episodes. It's spread out over a little under 2 hours. So you know, it's a little bit. It might just feel like it's being more straightforward this time around. But the fact that they're talking about how they're we're not really dealing with the religious symbolism this time around. That is bullshit. It is all over the second movie. Like, it's bathing in the religious symbolism stuff. So to pretend like it's not like that is, that's garbage. It's all in there. It's still in there, which I'm happy about because I like that stuff. I think it's cool.
It doesn't lose itself in the details of it as much. Like, they waste a lot less time, say, giving the angels gothic sounding names.
Yeah. Well, those are all names of actual angels, but yeah.
Right, actual angel names, but they don't waste time on that, and they concentrate more on the actual direct symbolism rather than, you know, there were a lot of issues with the first with the Evangelion TV series, where there were things that they just kind of took the names of things but didn't really pay much attention to what they symbolized.
Right. Yeah.
And that's not an issue anymore.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of people are looking at these movies and they're thinking, well, this is a better version, but I don't like to look at it that way. It's just different and it's exciting to see a new version. I'm fine with whatever changes they're making. I'm always happy to see a new version of a story I already like. So I think it's cool. But yeah, looking forward to the next one. I think it's going to be pretty crazy.
When's that due?
No one knows.
No.
It's maybe next year.
We don't even know if movies 3 and 4 are going to be separate movies or 2 episodes in one movie.
Yeah, they keep talking about like they're doing a third one and then the fourth one's like a epilogue or something like that. I mean, who knows?
Okay.
I don't know. They haven't. Whatever they know, they're not telling us. The big piece of news this week is that 4Kids is being sued by who is it?
No, it's by TV Tokyo and NAS, Nihon Ad Systems, which is. They're the two main producers of Yu-Gi-Oh!
Right, and Justin, you can probably break this down better than anybody.
Right, basically, they've pulled the license, and they filed this lawsuit that all of the deals that they made to distribute the show, either on DVD or on Cartoon Network, not all of them, but most of them, included some sort of unfulfilled kickback that they either didn't report or was left off the books, and so they never paid royalties on it. And something tipped them off last year, and so they did an audit, and they found, like, over $5 million of things that they should have been paid for contractually but weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all alleged, by the way.
Right.
So they basically were like, hey, 4Kids, this is a problem. And 4Kids gave them $1 million and said, hey, have a happy day. And they're like, no, wait, we have to resolve this. You owe us a lot more than this. And they're like, we don't know what you're talking about. Bye. Have a nice day.
And now they're going to court.
And now they're going to court, yeah. And, you know, normally when someone files a lawsuit against someone and pulls a license, it's one of those things where, well, we have to find out who's saying what here. But Japanese companies don't sue people.
Yeah.
This is a really unusual step. So it's you can bet that unless they had a really, really strong case, they wouldn't take the trouble of hiring American lawyers to sue them in American court. I mean, that's a huge undertaking for a Japanese company, so they must really, really think they have an amazing case here.
Well, if they want that other $4 million, I mean, if
4Kids has the $4 million.
4Kids probably doesn't have, I would imagine they do not have $4 million laying around, and it will destroy the company.
Already destroys the company. I mean, without Yu-Gi-Oh!, they don't have much.
No, they don't really have anything.
It couldn't be that they need the license back for some reason. Like, they want to do something, I don't know, like digitally distribute Yu-Gi-Oh! Or something.
And well, 4Kids was kind of already doing that. 4Kids, basically, how this worked was, unlike something like Funimation or somebody licensing the show, for something like this, 4Kids gets what's called the master license. And right. What that is 4Kids takes over all the merchandising, all the supervision of trademarks, everything. They dub it, but they don't, you know, it's a completely different model than most of us are used to over analyzing in the home video world. You know, home video world, usually all the costs are recoupable. There's a huge minimum guarantee. And then there's like down the road after all the costs are made back up, there's a little bit of back end, usually like 20% or thereabouts. In this case, it was 50-50 with 4Kids supposedly paying all of the development costs. But across every platform, toys, every distribution model, television, DVD, all that stuff.
So does anyone do kids in the States care about Yu-Gi-Oh?
Not really anymore. It's a pretty dead franchise. I mean, it was still on TV. There was a new series that was being produced by 4Kids.
Right. It still moves, but it's one of those, like, old, crusty stalwarts that just never went away rather than anything anyone was actually excited about.
Yeah. It was pretty handily knocked out of that slot by Pokemon, which is still huge here.
It's the same.
Yu-Gi-Oh came after Pokemon.
Yeah, it did, and it was almost as popular as Pokemon was for a few years, like 10 years ago.
Right,
like it was huge 10 years ago, but it faded. Pokemon never faded; it's still just as popular as it always was.
Right, I still see people trading Yu-Gi-Oh cards on occasion.
Yeah, but there's not like midnight release video games and people lining up and shit. No. It's not what it once was. But no, I don't think this isn't clearly.
The thing is, 4Kids doesn't have much else at this point. I mean, they lost Turtles, they lost Pokemon, they haven't had any other major big hits.
No, I mean, yeah, I think this is pretty much it for them. But it is interesting to see a Japanese company taking this drastic step. I think they're just kind of used to maybe getting shitty deals. I bet there's a lot of shitty deals out there we don't know about.
Or they're used to, like, getting angry, but then just kind of not dealing with that company again.
Right.
I mean, that's happened a lot.
Blacklisting, but, yeah.
The one kind of humorous footnote in this is that the other big case of a Japanese company suing the American distributor was also Yu-Gi-Oh!
Right. Upper
it was
Deck.
For the cards. It was Konami who owned the rights for the cards versus Upper Deck, and that one ended in hilarity.
What, Upper Deck was like printing out fakes on laser printers and like creating false demand or something like that.
Yeah, they were doing it in China. They looked like crap. I mean, people were screaming behind the scenes. People were throwing chairs. It was like a cartoon. And all this came out, like, I actually read the decision from the court. I have never read an entire court document for fun in my life. This was one of the best reads I've had in years. I was laughing so hard.
Wow. Is that floating around out there, or did you have special privilege?
No, that's publicly available. I'll have to dig up a link somewhere. But, yeah, I mean, there were tales of, like, scared secretaries talking about how the how executives would come in and like start throwing shit and like screaming at the top of their lungs, and it was just the jankiest operation, because they got in the fake cards printed in China and the colors didn't match at all and they looked horrible. And they're like, well, we can't do anything with this. And then they accidentally got shipped out to retailers.
Amazing.
It's a cursed franchise.
It really is.
There was supposed to be some 3D movie that screened once in New York a couple of weekends ago. But that's probably it for the franchise in North America.
Clearly
right
indicative
now.
Of strong demand.
Yeah, really. One screening. So before we get to some of the particularly silly Twitter questions that we have this week, Tim, you wrote a blog post about anime becoming the anime industry facing pretty much the exact same issue as the music industry faced, around the time of Napster. And I wanted you to talk about that a little bit. That was an interesting point.
I don't want to pull too many parallels between the anime industry and the music industry, because they're fundamentally quite different. But at the same time, they are both entertainment industries. And I think it's the similarity there. And this applies, to Hollywood, it applies to book publishing, it applies to anyone that's moving into that digital realm and where piracy is an issue. The thing that struck me about Napster was, and I had to explain to someone online what Napster was, because they were too young to remember Napster, man. Exactly. When was that? Like 98, 99, was it?
Yeah, 99.
But, this doesn't bear thinking about, but yeah, there were people out there, intelligent people, who I have conversations with regularly, who are too young to remember Napster. Anyway,
CDs older than you.
Yes, exactly. I've got comics older than you. I've got trousers older than you. Let's be honest. I got Napster was a file sharing program. Very briefly, it let you basically dip into other people's MP3 collections on their computer and swap files with people. You put in the name of a song you want, and it gave you a list of people who had them, and you just copied them off it.
It was the first big P2P platform.
Exactly. Yeah, it was the first big P2P, and what happened was very quickly a lot of people started using it, and the music industry had a complete spaz out, went completely crazy, and didn't know what was going on. And what was interesting about it at the time, and I remember thinking this at the time, is this: why are so many people using this, and why are so many people stealing music? And the answer everyone would give you was primarily because it was easy, and it was fairly easy to use Napster. I mean, it's probably, in fact, it was easier than most BitTorrent clients now, to be honest. It was a pretty straightforward piece of software. So people who over here were just getting broadband for the first time, it was an amazing thing to do and very easy, and you got free music. The other thing that always struck me about it was, though, is at the time, people didn't think it was worth buying music. It's the other thing that says, you know, they don't think it's worth paying for music. People, I know I certainly wasn't, and a lot of my friends did not hold the music industry with a lot of respect. You know, the music industry was seen, and arguably still is, as this huge monolithic group of a small number of companies that churn out product and will do anything they can to turn a buck off it. And they'll sell that product for advertising, they'll do product placement in videos, they'll do sponsorship. I mean, what they did to hip-hop in the 90s, in the late 90s, at turn of the century was, you know, they just turned it from being something really interesting into being this sort of, you know, MTV crib style cash machine where you just were just thrusting brands in people's faces all the time. And it's not the first time music industry's done that. Music industry's done that for about half a century. It did it with blues, it did it with rock and roll, it did it with punk, it did it with house music. It's done it with every genre that's come along. But it was less that people are stealing stuff because they're tight and they don't like spending money. It was more people are stealing stuff because they don't value the product anymore, and they don't value music as something that they want to invest in. You know, you would go on and, you know, Britney Spears was popular, and you type in Britney Spears and you'd get a Britney Spears MP3, and that was it. You know, Britney Spears, you turn the radio on, Britney Spears is on, you turn MTV on, Britney Spears is on, you watch something else, there's probably some Britney Spears music in the TV ad during your program you're watching, and you go, you know, everywhere you go, Britney Spears on the side of buses advertising this and that. It's, you know, Britney Spears doesn't have any value to the consumer. It's something you're going to listen to maybe for a few weeks and you're never going to listen to again. And most product the music industry was putting out sort of fell into that category. And it's impossible for me, and it just came up this week after reading that guy that used to write for Madhouse, what he'd said. It's impossible for me to not feel the same about anime, or to think that other people are feeling the same about anime. Even, you know, even people that are hardcore, you know, Moe fans and stuff, they will enjoy a show, but they know that show, I mean, you can see people discussing it, they know that show is just a bunch of tropes and a bunch of stereotypes and a bunch of cliches, and to them it's not necessarily something worth investing in, because they're probably going to go watch that show once, you know, and that's it. So it's, you know, ask them to spend, I don't know how much DVDs are over there, $20 on 4 episodes of it or something. I guess it's probably not so bad as that now. You know, it's a big ask, I think.
You're right in, I think, that comparison, and that's really one that hasn't been brought up a whole heck of a lot.
No, 'cause it's the elephant in the room. Like I said, I tried bringing it up. I actually, in a past life, I was an academic researcher, and one of the things I was looking at was electronic distribution of music, and it was something I tried bringing up to record companies and people, and they were like, no, it's not like that at all. And it's something they realise. You can see on their faces, they know they pushed everything too far. They pushed the money-making revenues out of a single product or a single brand too far. And then when that brand, i.e. an artist, has fulfilled all those obligations and is past its best, they just ditch it. They just ditch it. It's especially bad, not wanting to bring race into it, it's especially bad with black artists. You know, people have very short shelf lives. And people know it, they just don't want to talk about it, do you know what I mean? And I just, this week I just felt, I'm going to have to write something about this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the problems are different on a surface level, but very similar if you scratch beneath that. The industry, I mean, everybody, we talk about it on this show all the time, that there's a massive brain drain in the industry in Japan. There's a couple of people who are kind of exciting, but most of it is just, what will people buy? Let's make that. And that attitude over time will completely devalue the product, because people will say, like, the only reason you're making this is because you think you're hitting the right buttons in order to get me to open my wallet. And so they'll still consume it, but they don't have to pay for it because of piracy.
Right. This is sort of the equivalent of, you know, the grindhouse genre pictures of the 70s, or like the Italian sword and sandal garbage, you know.
Right.
where, you know, they're churning out product, but it's not good product. And so you might get a big initial bump, but no one's going to want to own it forever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And music is similar. The sort of thing that you want to hold on to forever is it's a rare beast. I mean, even in the best of artistic times, I'm happily buying a whole bunch of Blu-rays, but heck, almost all of them are movies that are over 10, 15 years old.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of truth to that as well. I think there's, I mean, you look at, the what I was trying to say in that piece as well is that, and I don't know if it came across, it's you can't be too negative about this. The industry, instead of sitting there bitching and whining and going, Americans are stealing our product, blah, 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 is to go, right, well, there's a market there. The people that are stealing your product still want your product, okay? And the problem is, you have to make it as easy as possible to get them, for them to get your product. And if that means giving it them for free, then that means giving them for free. If that means, you know, free streaming. The example I use is iTunes. And iTunes as a model doesn't fit anime at all. But Apple came along and said, right, no one's buying your product. They're stealing your product because they don't value it. We're going to give it a value. And that value was, like, what was it, like 69 cents?
99 cents, right? Yeah.
And the music industry went, whoa, what are you talking about? And Apple basically said, no, that's the value of your product, man. That's the value of your product. That's what people will pay. And by paying that tiny amount, it guarantees them one, they haven't got to mess around with long download times. They haven't got to mess around with the legality of it. They haven't got to mess around with Napster playing up. And they haven't got them. And the guaranteed quality, you know, they guaranteed a certain quality. Because the problem with Napster is you download it off someone and it was a terrible rip and it sounded dreadful. And you know, it was a waste of time and it took you an hour to download it and blah.
I think we all have a few glurpy MP3s from that era still.
Yeah, I do, definitely.
We still do. I mean, unfortunately, there's stuff I can't actually replace that I got off Napster. You know, I used to get a lot of bootlegs and things like that off it. Anyway, right. What I'm saying is there's a market of people there. You just have to know how to connect to that market. And even if you're giving them the product for free, it's better than them stealing it because it's your product and there's other things that are associated with that, like merchandising, like product placement, like advertising, like your brand, right, that you can give to them. If it means you have to give them for free, it is better than them stealing it because you still have control over how you give it to them. Arguably, you don't want to let the studios have too much control, which is obviously the problem we've seen in the last few months and stuff. But, you know, like I said in the piece, I don't have the answers. It's not for me to have the answers. I hope there's someone somewhere else that's clever enough to have answers, and that's their job to come up with these answers.
Well, you know, I hear that argument a lot from fans. I think it's a noble ideal to aspire to. But the problem is, you know, a lot of 90% of anime is not easily merchandisable.
No.
I mean, who is really going to buy and wear in public T-shirts for a moe show?
I can think of a couple people.
There are a few people who are not, you know, self-conscious about that sort of thing. But let's face it, most teenagers wear that to high school. They get beat up.
Yeah, I
guess that's the thing. And what I skirted around in that argument was, you know, I didn't want it to become my personal opinion on why anime is shit. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, I didn't want to go, right, people devalue, anime's been devalued because it's all shit, because it's very easy for me to say that. People expect me to say that. I believe that to a certain extent. But that isn't just the argument, because that's an argument for me nicking it. It's for me stealing it. It's not an argument for fans stealing it, right? So there has to be a rationale for fans who don't think that the product is shit for also refusing to pay for it. It's easy for me to go. I mean, the big one everyone talks to me about is Redline. That comes out in a couple of months over here on Blu-ray. I'll buy the Blu-ray. I will lend it to a friend, a few friends of mine I know of, who don't watch much anime, if any, and go, watch this. They will watch it, and I know for a fact that they will then buy that Blu-ray, right? Because that's a product that isn't shallow and isn't disposable, despite it actually being quite a shallow product at some levels.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's kind of shallow.
It is kind of shallow, but it's also fucking beautiful, and I know people that will freak out over that and will want a copy just so they can show it to other people, right? Literally, that's why they'll go and buy a copy. So when their mates come around, they'll go, look at this. And I think a part of that as well is nurturing talent. And I think that's the thing that maybe you also need to learn from the music industry. So take Radiohead, who their last two albums, they have released themselves online through their own website. And I don't know exactly how they did the last album, but the preceding album to that. You could download it for free, or you could make a donation. Or there was various other ways of buying it. You could buy limited edition CDs and limited edition box sets and posters.
That's interesting, but that's not nurturing talent.
Yeah, that's because they can do that because they're Radiohead.
It's them nurturing their own talent. Like it's them going to their fans. If you want us to carry on making albums, which we don't do that often, you need to pay for it. And it's worked. It's worked for them. It's worked for a few other bands. There's a few other people doing. The other guy, obviously, is very mouthy about his things, is Cory Doctorow. And what he does with his books, as soon as every single one of his books is released, he gives away free e-copies of it.
All these things sound really easy, but you know, for an established band, it's maybe something you can get away with.
Yeah,
for
exactly.
People just starting off, it's just not.
You're right. It's not unless you can do something really amazing, and then I think maybe you can do it. I honestly believe that. I think if you can do something that really grabs people's attention, then. But it's risk-taking. I think it's risk-taking. That's the problem, Justin, is risk-taking. And you know better than I do, this is an industry that at the moment is just not interested in taking any risks whatsoever.
Well, taking a risk is a luxury. Taking a risk is something that you can do when you don't have to worry about feeding yourself. You don't quit your job when you're $30,000 in credit card debt.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, the industry is simply not in a position to take risk, because if they do, anything that shuts off even more revenue at this point has serious consequences. Everyone's just trimmed down to their absolute core. So, what do you do? Rock in a hard place.
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem. I don't pretend to have any answers, and it's not a particularly cheerful discussion, because it's hard to see the industry the way it is, as you've just described, and B, the amount of product, the kind of product that's been put out, rather, how you can get past this, like you say, rock and a hard place situation at the moment.
Gloom and doom all around.
Jump off a bridge.
Let's get to some Twitter questions, because these are pretty lighthearted. How about that? Okay, from Exidor UK. Wants to know, this is obviously a question for Tim, what are the biggest differences between the Japanese, British, and U.S. techno scenes and styles?
If people don't know, I DJ as well. I'm old, I used to DJ like 20 years ago, and I just started recently getting back into it. And I play house and techno, and techno's very cyclic. It goes in cycles. When I was a kid, it was very popular and disappeared for a long time. And it's kind of come back again. It's always sort of popular in Central Europe. I don't know. So the British scene's just kind of come back. America's got a weird techno scene in that it kind of originates in America, in Detroit specifically, and outside of sort of Detroit and Chicago and maybe LA and New York and a couple of places. There isn't really much of a scene at all. It's never really caught on over there. Japan loves techno. And from what I can tell, Japan's never really given up on techno since the 90s. And there's some really good nights over there. Probably the best sort of techno blog in the world is It's Minimal Sausages, which is written by an Australian guy who lives in Tokyo. And he was the guy who's organizing a hashtag on Twitter, which is Techno for Japan, which was something I was involved in for a little while, which was getting labels and DJs and stuff to put out free music and mixes and stuff in return for people donating to the Red Cross and stuff.
It seems like it's hard to really say this is popular in Japan and this isn't popular in Japan, because that whole market is so regimented and so like niche based. So, like, I mean, Japan is the reason that the 80s Eurobeat guys are still making 80s Eurobeat music when exactly. No one else wants it.
Okay, well, I go to record shop here, but Bristol's different. Bristol's got a very vibrant music scene, and we invented drum and bass here, arguably, and some other sort of subgenres of music. And I go in record shops here, and you hear drum and bass, you hear dubstep being played. When I went over to Tokyo a couple of years ago, and I went in record shops, I heard techno being played, and I walked in, and I was surprised, because I hadn't heard techno like that for years. And it wasn't old techno, it was new stuff, and it was either stuff that was being produced in Europe and was being imported to Japan, or it was stuff that Japan itself was producing. There's some fantastic producers over there, and some great DJs. And the club scene... we didn't go when we were over there, we were meant to, and then we were too tired and blah, I mean, never got around to doing it, which is a shame. I'd love to go over there and check the clubs out and stuff over there. It probably all sounds really weird to your listeners. Well, I'm going about techno.
Honestly, I'm really shocked at how big techno is here in LA.
I knew LA's got quite a big scene, and San Fran's got quite a big scene as well.
I was not prepared for that. I mean, in New York, we had the chiptune scene. LA, I mean, Above and Beyond had their big, you know, that giant show here at the Hollywood Bowl. I think that was the Hollywood Bowl, own Palladium. Anyway, I passed by the lines, not knowing that was happening, and it was like, you know, lines around five city blocks. It was crazy.
Wow. Nice.
And I was just like, this for Above and Beyond, really?
It seems like it was out of style for most of the last decade, and it's kind of come back in the last couple of years, maybe 3-4 years.
I'm not used to my what I like music-wise being cool. It's freaking me out.
Yeah, but the thing with techno, really, like Detroit techno, proper techno, I get told off for saying that, but yeah, is, you know, emerging in the late 80s and early 90s in Detroit, and it very much summed up, I mean, Justin, I know you're from that area, so it very much summed up.
Yeah, but I wasn't paying attention to anything but my own depression.
Well, it kind of came up, and it kind of summed up the experience of sort of black inner city in Detroit and stuff. And it just got completely overshadowed by hip-hop. And when the American mainstream heard techno, they assumed it had come from Europe, and they assumed it had been made by white guys. And it kind of got forgotten in America, and those guys never sold any records. And then suddenly, literally, you know, you read stories and biographies of people like Derek Ray and stuff, and who started that scene, and then literally getting phone calls from London and from Berlin, and people going, can you come and play? We need 10,000 copies of your record. Because stuff was doing ridiculously. I mean, Kevin Saunderson, who was one of the Detroit techno pioneers, literally had to fly over here to be on television because he had a number one hit single, you know. From Detroit, he'd never made any money selling records before that. It's a weird part of sort of American subculture. It's kind of got lost from mainstream history, I think, in a way.
All right, well, moving on then.
Sorry, that was a weird one, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, hey, a lot of these are weird. We got a couple from Ed Sizemore.
Yeah, I bet you are.
Sprinkled out here. He wants to know if it's true that you have to be high to enjoy District 9. I've heard that you have to dull the mental facilities to get that movie.
He's only seen it once. The boy needs to sit down and watch it again.
Honestly, I saw it. I bought the Blu-ray, and it did not hold up on the second view for me.
Like, really?
Really, like, yeah, no, I felt like it was a little ham-fisted, and the special effects, you can tell, were super budget special effects. It's a bad movie. I don't think it's bad. It's just I was kind of blown away by it the first time, and on a second viewing... If you already kind of know all the beats going in, and it just doesn't it does not have even remotely the same impact for me the second time. I don't know if I'll ever revisit it again.
I've watched it probably like half a dozen times at least, and yeah, you're right about special effects on Blu-ray in particular. Yes. I saw it twice at cinema, I've watched it a bunch of times on Blu-ray, and yeah, the special effects don't hold up. I love that film. As a science fiction writer, it was a really important film for me. Yeah, it's a little ham-fisted, it's a little rough around the edges. It was important for me because it was fun, it had action, it was cool, it had good design, and three, it had a message, and people watched it. You know, it managed to do all those three things. Yeah, Avatar tried to do all three things and didn't quite get it. I still think it rules over Avatar massively. I love that film. I love it. I absolutely adore that film. It's like one of my... I'd put that in my top five films probably of all time, which is a big deal for me. Yeah. There's some big films up in there.
Yeah, I don't know. Justin, you never went back to that one, right?
I did buy the Blu-ray, and I don't picture myself sitting wrapped in front of the TV ever again watching it. But
his performance, Chateau Copley's performance, that is phenomenal.
Oh, no, it's very well made. It's a fantastic piece of acting. I'm not arguing that point at all. But it's, I think that movie is very, I mean, it's a very, how should I put this? It's a movie that is very dependent on grabbing a hold of you, like emotionally. It's very reliant on suspense.
Mm.
And I think, just movies like that are structured like that use that method of storytelling usually don't have anywhere near the same effect on rewatchings, and that's no knock on it. That's just the price of using that sort of narrative technique.
Have you guys seen Children of Men?
Oh yeah, a couple times.
No, in my queue.
It's really good. You're gonna like. I think you're gonna like that one a lot, Justin.
Yeah,
it's a fantastic film. It's another movie. It's a lot subtler. It's a lot quieter than District 9, but it's still got these amazing action sequences in it. It's got like two, three, maybe amazing action sequences. One towards the end, which is phenomenally shot. It's a lot more serious than District 9, arguably. That's another one to me. I like science fiction films that take a premise that's slightly ridiculous and make it feel, and this goes for literature as well, makes it feel very realistic.
Did you like Cloverfield?
No, I don't really like any J.J. Abrams stuff. Okay.
Oh, really?
It's
wow.
Like him and Whedon are just...
Oh, I wouldn't lump those two together at all, but okay.
I kind of do lump them together because I think that they have taken an approach to science fiction, which is, for me, I can understand why they've done it, but it misses the point, which is the problem with science fiction is how do you make it appeal to a wide audience? And Whedon and Abrams, to me, have done that by taking a science fiction premise and then building a soap opera around it. And I don't enjoy that. I didn't enjoy Lost. I didn't enjoy Cloverfield. I know that what he was trying to do with Cloverfield, but I didn't enjoy it. I don't enjoy any Whedon stuff for the same reason. The way you make science fiction appeal to a wide audience is by using science fiction to talk about issues that people face. But in a way that only science fiction can. And it's very hard to do, and you have to get circumstances right, and you have to have a really good idea. That doesn't mean it's impossible to do. You know, I mean, I sit down and watch, you know, Firefly or something like that. I can't watch it, and it's just people babbling on, Americans in American clothes with American hair, babbling on about their relationships and stuff.
Our hair is different?
What, sorry?
Our hair is different?
Yeah, American TV, you have your own hair, man. We don't have hair like that in Europe, you know? It terrifies me. You know, I miss out on a lot of stuff. People go, oh, So-So's really good. They're going, oh, the hair, I can't watch it. But, you know, seriously, there's that approach. And in a way, sort of Doctor Who's gone a bit like that as well over here. It's gone a bit kind of...
Too Hollywood, too polished.
Too Hollywood. It's post-Buffy, yeah. Buffy, I know a lot of people love it. It never clicked for me, but it showed, basically, not beating around the bush, it showed that you could make a science fiction or genre show that appealed to a wide audience, i.e. in network speak, to women as well as men, right? That's really what the networks want. When they want a genre show, how can you make that appeal to a female demographic as well? Because a male demographic on its own doesn't shift advertising enough. And Abrahams is very good at doing that. Lost was a soap opera, you know. Whedon's very good at doing it. Buffy was a soap opera, was a teen soap opera or whatever. You know, you have all this relationship stuff. You have all this personal life stuff. It's why Heroes went wrong, blah, blah, blah. You know, I could go on all night about it. But I do believe something like District 9, Children of Men, appeals to a wide audience, however momentarily. It does it because it goes, this is fun, and it goes, look, there's something to think about, you know. I think that's why Avatar did so well. I think Avatar did really well because however heavy-handed it was, a lot of people got the message. And with a lot of people who were, you know, were pissed off about the Iraq War and pissed off about the environment and went, oh, yeah, look, you know, we're behind the Super Smurfs or whatever, you know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
We got to get some of those other questions though. Okay, so actually that was the next question, which we should cover in brief, but All About Manga wants to know whether or not you like Doctor Who, but I guess you just gave us
No, I don't really like Doctor Who. I'm the only guy in Britain that doesn't like Doctor Who, apparently.
Right, so speaking of which, Ed Sizemore also wants to know if I'm ashamed that I wrote off Fractal so quickly and if I'll be printing a retraction. No and no. No.
Oh, Ed.
Everything I've read about that show, everyone's saying, like, well, this didn't really live up to the promise that it
had.
Yeah,
people seem to be really disappointed by it.
Yeah, I guess he's still a big fan. It had some cheerleaders that are maybe just stubborn cheerleaders, I guess.
I've not seen it. Went to watch it. It was region locked. Next.
Okay, let's see here. Same. Okay, more from Ed. Thoughts on the Naoi Tamanei block. Overall, have you enjoyed the series? I guess in the block, was this season a costly misstep? Has it had any impact in Japan? Okay, so the Naoi Tamanei block generally is where I'm going to find the shows that I'm interested in every season. But as we've seen, the ratings are shit because I don't know. Justin, you had a thought on this?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of the stuff that we think of with the big hits of the block were, you know, things like Honey and Clover, things like Moyashimon, things like, you know, Nana, which appealed to a very wide base. They weren't ostensibly fantasy shows, which only appeal to people who are into fantasy. And as all we all know, that's a pretty narrow segment of the population. They were shows that were, you know, realistic, different in how it was approached as anime. And had real style to them. It almost reminded me, the block itself, of the block in the early 90s that had Marmalade Boy and Boys Over Flowers and Neighborhood Story. So it's one of those things where I think that the shows that they've chosen to green light might be veering way back towards the rest of anime that's just sitting there and enjoying its little popularity with its little small fan base.
Right. Yeah. So they basically have stopped attempting, like, making smart shows for a relevant audience.
Right. It's back to the rest of the fantasy of anime world. And
What were the shows the last season? Because what was in the block?
No, it was Kuragi Hime was in there. I think. Well, you know, I can't tell you off the top of my head, but
yeah.
The ones that stuck out to me that I actually really liked were like House of Five Leaves. I thought was pretty good. And
that was excellent.
Yeah, Tatami Galaxy is on my pile of shame right now. Still haven't gotten to it, but
it's good. I dipped into it. I still haven't sat down and watched the whole thing. The one show that I love from that block was Mononoke from years back.
No, I never saw that. Did you ever see? Did you see that, Justin?
No, I didn't. That's another one that's been on the pile. All right, so actually, Tokyo Magnitude 8.0, that was Noitanima.
Yeah, that was one. That was, yeah, of course, that was. Yeah.
And we, going back further, we had Eden of the East and Nodama Kantabire.
Okay, yeah, of course they were. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm freakily the only person in the world that doesn't like Eden of the East much. Mononoke is really worth watching. It's never been licensed, unfortunately, which it should be. It's just, it's very, very creepy. It's very sinister, and it's got this incredible art style to it. It's incredibly stylish.
Horror anime has never really done all that well here.
It's not really horror. It is. It's got a horror. It's got that sort of traditional Japanese horror sort of aspect to it, but it's too colourful for horror. It's very bright. It's not sort of lurking in shadows, making you jump horror. It's kind of freaking you out. And the way it freaks you out is through how stylish it is, and the art style, like I say, is quite experimental at times. It's the first episode, it's got some beautifully shot sequences in it. There's a shot from above of all these spinning discs, and it just lit. Well, you don't know it's from above. It's just these spinning discs, and it's on this amazing shot, and this conversation going on. And you go, what am I looking at? And then the camera switches, and you realise they're these geisha girls are umbrellas spinning, and it's things like that. It's just wow to watch it. It's just really, really beautiful, and you don't see a lot of that. It's only like 9 episodes, I think, or something. It's that's literally one of my favourite shows. Absolutely fantastic.
Huh, cool. Okay. okay, also from Ed.
Wow.
This is going to be the last Ed question. He wants to know if superhero films are in danger of wearing out their welcome, and what films should we keep an eye out for this summer? Well, on the superhero question, this may be the last summer where we have 8 of them in a single summer, but I guess that's not true because next summer will be Batman and the Avengers, and yeah, I don't know. America's thirst for superhero movies doesn't really seem to be abating anytime soon. I'm personally kind of a little burned out on them. I'm not really excited about any of the ones coming out this summer. It's probably because I don't care about any of those characters, but yeah.
I can't say I'm particularly interested. The only one I'd be interested in now is the new Batman film, just because, and that's not really because it's Batman, it's just because it's Nolan, and I've enjoyed all his films today. You know, I think that's about it, really. I was prepared to be excited about Watchmen, and it was kind of not exciting. Yeah, that's about it. Like I said, I'm not a massive superhero fan, though, to be fair.
I can't stand superheroes, and I avoid all those movies like the plague.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. It's really not your thing at
all. No.
But in terms of this...
I don't even like Japanese superheroes.
it occurs to me, though, that this summer, in particular, looking at the slate, it is a sequel orgy. And the only one I'm particularly looking forward to, I guess, would be the last Harry Potter. I mean, I really liked the first part of the last movie last year.
Yeah, I did too. That was beautiful.
It was really good. And I mean, the end of that book is a fucking mess. It's a poorly written, confusing, really, really messy piece of shit. And I'm hoping that the movies do what they've done throughout pretty much the entire series, which is improve it, improve the writing, streamline the storyline, make it make sense.
You mean you don't want 4 pages of expository dialogue while Harry and Voldemort walk in a circle pointing their wands at each other?
Yeah, that's just not going to work. So I would imagine the Steve Kloves, the guy who writes those, he knows what he's doing. So I have every faith that it'll be pretty good. But other than that, nobody asked for another fucking Pirates movie. Nobody wants them.
No, I don't get those films. Like, I've never sat for a whole one. I get fidgety and then I'm off watching something else.
But
don't get it.
Yeah, even the Pixar this year is Cars 2, so fuck that shit.
Is that the only thing Pixar have got this year?
This year, that's it. They've got, next year they'll have another original, not a sequel. But this year it's Cars, which I know why they're making it. It is, they've made something like $5 billion in merchandising or something like that since the first one came out, so it's huge for them. But I'm not those movies are, that's like the one Pixar franchise that is really not, feels like it's not for me, not even with me considered in mind as a viewer. So whatever, but yeah, kind of a lame summer, but we'll see. It's usually there's some kind of a surprise in August or something, but last year we had the surprise was Scott Pilgrim, so that was, we're not going to get another one of those this year.
No, let's not get into that.
Let's not get into that, Tim. I know you're not a fan.
I'll tell you what, your surprise film this year is Attack the Block. I'm going to big that up. It's a British movie.
Oh, yeah, that's supposed to be really good.
Yeah. I've not seen it. It's everything I know about it. I know the guy who's directed it, Adam Cornish, is a comedian over here. He's very talented. It's Edgar Wright production. It's set on like a housing estate here, like what you'd call a project over there, I guess. And it's about like really grimy street kids. There's all this bullshit about them wanting to put subtitles on it in the States. I don't know if that's happening or not, which is hilarious because it's just like kids from down my street, sort of how they talk, you know. And it's kind of this sort of like homage to, what's the film? The Aliens film from the 80s.
Alien?
No, the comedy version of that.
Critters?
Oh, man. Critters, yeah. It's kind of like this kind of sort of Critters homage and stuff. Sounds like, basically it sounds like Shaun of the Dead with aliens. It sounds like it could be a lot of fun.
Now well, we didn't want to tell you, but we're having to annotate this entire podcast with subtitles.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, that's a good place to call it quits. So, listen, Tim, thanks for coming by and shooting the shit with us. I really appreciate it.
Anytime, man. Really, it's a pleasure. Anytime.
Okay. Okay, that's our show. Thanks, Tim, for coming on. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. And don't forget, review the show on iTunes. We'll see you all next week.